This is the Friday feature for September 10th. I'm Ken Myers. One of the guests on the most recent edition of the Mars Hill Audio Journal, that's volume 151, is Scott Neustock. He's the author of How to Think Like Shakespeare, Lessons from a Renaissance Education. Today, I want to share with our listeners portions of my conversation with Neustock, for which we didn't have room on that journal volume. If you've already heard that volume of the journal, you'll know that Scott Neustock's book doesn't offer a step-by-step procedural account of how to think like Shakespeare. Rather, he describes patterns and habit-inducing practices that contain the possibility of intellectual growth. As he explains in the book's introductory chapter, Scott Neustock is eager to encourage his readers to, quote, explore what seem to me to be the key aspects of thinking and how to hone them. As both a teacher and a parent of school-aged children, I've become dismayed by the way we think of thinking. While dismay first animated my writing, I'm hopeful that Shakespearean habits of mind can help us hold a mirror up to current dogma. Close quote. The dogma that Neustock has in mind concerns not just how we think about thinking, but also how we think about the ends and means of education. After all, Neustock reminds his readers that education must be about thinking. Education, adequately understood, is much more than training a set of specific and often mechanical skills. Neustock is convinced that many efforts at educational reform, for example, like those funded by the Gates Foundation, fail to describe thinking adequately. Such reform efforts typically rely on quantitative measurement and thus on standardized tests to evaluate their effectiveness. But Neustock argues that this quantitative bias undermines the efforts of teachers to form habits of good thinking in their students. A preoccupation with test scores has become increasingly common in K-12 schools, but since he's a professor of education at Rhodes College, I asked Scott Neustock if the same disordering preoccupations were evident in higher education.
I think the waters are creeping up at the college level slowly from the primary and secondary school level. I mean, in part, this is indirectly in part animated by the Gates Foundation, which is, now that it's kind of done its disastrous thing nationwide on the primary and secondary levels, they've turned their attention to the post-secondary level, and they want some of the same kinds of standardization and centralization that they were pushing for the last couple of decades at lower levels. So I don't think any level of the educational system is immune to this dynamic. And it's also just a human dynamic that we all tend to, I think that's a natural tendency to lean towards wanting more of those measurable things, and there's tendencies towards bureaucracy that are very typically human in terms of organizational direction. One thing I guess that's been striking to me that animated the book again was my own children's experience of education as they've been working their way through various types of schools and various levels of schools at the primary and secondary levels. You know, Memphis in some ways was the epicenter of a number of the shifts towards high stakes testing assessment that happened in the first decade of the 21st century here, in part because they got a huge infusion of money from the Gates Foundation, and they were also one of the recipients of the Race to the Top funding. So they had a kind of intense cross pressure from a major foundation and a major federal funding to very quickly ramp up a series of numerical assessments for teachers and students that really within the space of a few years changed the way a lot of teachers who are my friends felt about what it was like to teach within this system. It, not surprisingly, it increased stress. It did not lead to the hope for outcomes in terms of making the improvements that were sought. And I think there was a lot of damage that was done inadvertently. It certainly wasn't the intent to induce that damage. But I think a lot of people had the joy sucked out of teaching based on high stakes assessments that were being done system wide in a very quickly implemented manner. Hmm. In the midst of all this, I have a very stark memory of being at a board retreat where we had a series of panels and presenters about contemporary educational trends. And one day there was a panel of wealthy private school administrators who were fairly uniformly describing ways in which they were trying to de-emphasize testing. Some of them were even moving away from AP classes because they felt like they weren't animating the kind of thinking that they wanted to see in their graduates. Some of them had decided to eliminate grades and move towards more narrative evaluations of their students. So I found that really striking, that some of the most well-resourced schools in the country were devoting a lot of attention to rethinking numerical evaluation and its virtues and its limits. And then the very next day, we had someone from the Gates Foundation speak about their efforts in Memphis public schools, and it just came across as incredibly punitive and antagonistic to teachers and skeptical of teachers in the classroom, and as if they needed to be disciplined and redirected in all kinds of ways. And there are certainly many problems in schools all across the country. The contrast was so striking. The latitude that the private school administrators were describing that they were giving themselves, and then the kind of, again, frankly, kind of hostile administrative sense that was being imposed upon the teachers. Again, many of whom are my friends and neighbors and people whom I have great admiration for. So in some ways, what that anecdote reminds us of is that part of this is it relates to just resources. You know, evaluative forms, narrative forms of evaluation are much more costly and time-consuming and demanding than a bubble sheet is. And when we're talking about maldistribution of resources for education, we can very quickly identify schools that don't have the same kinds of resources as other schools have. But still, the contrast was just so striking in my mind. And something else that was even more vivid in the midst of all that, my eldest daughter, who I discussed briefly in the book, was probably about 7 years old right then. And I'm sitting in the midst of this presentation by the Gates Foundation representative. I'm frustrated. I'm feeling defensive on behalf of my friends who are teachers, and I'm trying to, in my head, work out what's so aggravating about the way this was being presented. And at that very moment, in the midst of my frustration, I received a text photograph from my wife, which was an image that my 7-year-old had constructed on the refrigerator with that magnetic poetry, those little individual words you can rearrange. And it said, "I hate school," which was something that I would never want any child to say, and certainly not a child that was embarking on her school career at that moment. But it was in part because she was being inundated with already anxiety about test preparation at age 7, and it was percolating into the entire school building through the loudspeaker and through practice testing sessions and so on. So, you know, a lot of this was animated by that moment, which I just thought was a tragic moment, especially given that she did have great teachers and people who really loved their students. But there were these outside forces that were, I think, distorting the point of the whole process. So, you know, for a while, as I was drafting the book, a lot of it was animated by frustration and anger. And I had to, with the good advice of my editor, I worked really hard to tone that down and make it a positive celebration about things I love about education rather than a rant, which some of the early drafts were.
Well, I think you and your editor succeeded nicely because it doesn't come across that way. Was this the same daughter? You tell the story about asking your daughter about what she learned that week.
Yeah, it was just a few weeks after that, I think, where she's a very bright kid and already was a good reader, and we just were kind of informally asking her what word she had learned that week in school. And she kind of looked at us coldly, this otherwise vivacious child, and said, assessment. And my wife and I both had to kind of chuckle and go, yeah, we've never used that word in our home. And it's really striking that that's already something that she's picked up on as a new word that's kind of intruded upon her imagination. And shortly thereafter, I also had another exchange with her teacher, who was just a heroic human being who had clearly tried to shield her students from all of those external forces as much as she possibly could. Just a fantastic teacher who I saw firsthand what amazing work she was doing in the classroom as I was a volunteer literacy tutor for her. And some announcement came over the loudspeaker about test prep again, and it just felt disruptive and it felt intrusive. And I kind of turned to her, someone who I had never really had a conversation with before, and I asked her what she thought of all of it. And she just looked at me and she said, I think it's cruelty to children. Mm. And she was right. She meant it. It was not as well-intentioned as that. All those reforms were, the outcome was you were under a kind of regime of outside evaluation, and you should be stressed about it, and you should be worried about it, and your teachers might be punished for your bad behavior or your bad performance. So that was part of the seed of the book. And then simultaneously, as I was teaching, I was thinking a lot about Shakespeare's own intellectual formation and his career formation, and trying to think about revivifying the things that are valuable from that type of education that seemed to contradict some of the things that I was frustrated by in contemporary Memphis and contemporary United States education.
Because you refrained from writing a mere rant, you don't explain what you think the causes of those distortions of education are. But I assume that one of the causes, I mean, obviously there is a kind of mentality that is preoccupied with algorithms and uniform approaches to things. Part of its economies of scale. But I wonder to what extent is the end of education assumed to be with as much energy as any Soviet regime ever had to make good workers, to make good players, contributors to the economy.
Mm-hmm.
That's motivating some of the parents that I mentioned. Their principal concern is that they want their kids to get a good job.
Mm-hmm.
Not that parents should be unconcerned with their children having a livelihood. But I wonder whether there's a deep failure to appreciate what else there might be. I mean, including, I think you mentioned the Aristotelian goal of forming good citizens.
Right. And I, you know, in my naive, most idealistic moments, I would like to think it's something even more grandiose than that, which is finding ways to help people become fully flourishing human beings and fully engaged with all of the range of imaginative possibilities of what a human being can do and be and say and articulate. But in some ways, even the job end, the end of getting a job, is even that would be more ambitious than what I feel like ends up happening in practice, which is the end kind of collapses into the means.
Mm-hmm.
And the goal of education seems to be to pass the test to get to the next round of the education rather than something else deeper that's animating the engagement as it's happening. And we have many examples of people from the social sciences going back decades who were very sharp about pointing out ways in which what's the classic phrase? If a measure becomes a target, it fails to serve as a good measure mm-hmm. anymore. That there's a distorting dynamic where if you fixate on the measurement and you turn that into the goal, then weirdly the goal kind of collapses upon itself, and then I think it induces a lot of cynicism and a lot of disengagement about why do we have to do this thing? Oh, it's to pass the test, so that way you can continue doing this at the next level, rather than this is a fascinating verbal object, or this is a beguiling piece of a thing that a human created, and what might have animated their interest in making this thing in the first place, and why did they do it at this moment in time, in this culture, in this nation, in this context? I mean, I can point. I'm most familiar with the dynamic of that testing-driven pattern in reading and literacy, and I don't know if you've looked at all at any of the kind of primary school standardized tests for reading comprehension, but it ends up turning reading into a very bizarre activity, which is dissimilar from the ways in which and the reasons why anybody reads in the real world. And it turns reading into a kind of a hostile, context-free dynamic where you're kind of trying to go in and extract the meaning somehow, absent the context of, like, why would someone have said this in the first place, or why would someone phrase this way in the first place? So I think it's easy to complain about testing and it's easy to complain about assessment, but what I was trying to do was think through, okay, what is lacking in those kinds of systems or regimes, and is there a different way that we can talk about evaluating, and not to give up on evaluation, but find another lexicon or another register of describing what really does work when education works as well as we would like it to.
One thought comes to mind as you're describing that. It's almost as if the test-based systems are designed to extinguish wonder.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, there's one of the things I try to do in the book is acknowledge a lot of other voices and a lot of other pieces of inspiration. And so one example of that is a mathematician named Paul Lockhart, who wrote a short manifesto called the Mathematician's Lament. And he basically says, this is maybe a decade or two ago, but it's the same spirit as what I'm saying, that in some ways, if you wanted to, it would be hard to design a system that would take the joy out of math better than the system that he was frustrated with as he was looking at elementary school math pedagogy. And he comes up with what I think is a really great analogy, where he says, he kind of games it out, what if you taught music in the way that math is often taught? And basically, it's almost like you've inverted the pyramid of how you should progress towards music appreciation. Normally, you would think, expose kids to great music that they love and get them engaged with it, and then kind of build off of that and find ways to take that wonder or excitement and push it further and go, did you notice this is a reason why this works as well as it does, or maybe you might want to consider how this is structured in this way. And it's almost like we've done the inversion of that with math, where you start with the kind of a lot of abstract principles rather than the kind of joy of mathematics and the what animated someone to try to figure out this problem in the first place. And so even math turns into something that is kind of drained of its wonder and drained of the beauty of patterning. And then it turns into, again, the same dynamic, a similar dynamic of, well, we need to do this to pass the test, rather than, you know, why did Newton, why was he worried about or interested in or fascinated by the acceleration of a falling object? And how could you analogously occupy that mental space and try to go through the steps that it would take to think through about the acceleration of a falling object? My ideal fantasy kind of utopian curriculum or school would be a place where a lot of those kinds of inquiries would be driven by placing the child or the student in the position of the inquirer. Like, why would someone write a manifesto like this in 1776, or why would someone craft a painting like this at this moment, to not make it feel like it was alien to them, but rather that they were reoccupying that position, trying to figure out how this thing works from the inside out.
Scott Neustock, the author of How to Think Like Shakespeare, Lessons from a Renaissance Education. Neustock is professor of English and founding director of the Pierce Shakespeare Endowment at Rhodes College. You can hear more from my conversation with him on volume 151 of the Mars Hill Audio Journal. If you're not a subscriber, you can sign up today. You'll also hear Holly Ordway discussing some of the surprising books read by J.R.R. Tolkien. It turns out he was a big fan of Agatha Christie. Volume 151 also includes an interview with Robin Phillips about the challenge of sustaining a posture of gratitude in the midst of suffering. Junius Johnson talks with me about some of the elements of a theology of beauty, and musicologist Peter Mercer Taylor explains how a large body of 19th century American hymnody was inspired by classical music. If you're not ready to subscribe to the journal just yet, you can still purchase this volume a la carte from the catalog pages on our website. That's all for this week. I'm Ken Myers.